Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
November 8th, 2014, episode 67. Wait, what? Hi, everyone. This is Kevin England, and welcome to another edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast, episode 67. Can you imagine that? They just keep going, and don't know where all the time has gone. I have a lot of things to talk about on this episode, as usual, and I'm going to have a partner in crime this time. Say hello, Bob Kloss, to everybody.
Yes, hello, everyone. Hi, Kevin. Good to be here.
Glad to have you on. It's been a while since we've had the chat on a podcast, and we're trying a new recording method. We're literally doing this by telephone and using a device to record what we have going on. And I know my voice is a little messed up, but you sound pretty good, so I think we'll be good. Bob, this is going to be just you and I chatting about a bunch of different stuff that we have on a pile.
That sounds good to me.
I guess we can't break tradition. We have to go into the local hive report. So the local hive report is pretty simple. Took the feeders off the hive this past week. Actually, Sharon did it for me. We had a really warm day, about 66 degrees on Wednesday, and she was able to just pop them off. I should have done it beforehand, but I've been in Las Vegas and then had a lot of catch-up to do when I got back. I still, Bob, haven't done anything with that nucleus colony. It's sitting out there. It's down to about one frame.
You know what's going to happen, don't you? You're not going to get to it. You're going to leave it, and this one framer is somehow going to survive the winter.
Yeah, I looked in there today, actually, and that's a story in itself, right? For the local hive report, I tried to open that hive. I was going to take the queen out and put the other bees in. Following a recommendation from a listener, is just smoke everybody in the top bar hive and smoke what's left of those bees and put them in the top bar without a queen. So I was going to make them queenless. Well, as soon as I opened them, came off the top, and I didn't have any gear on. I had them smoked, but they chased me out of the yard. And what did I do, Bob?
You did something that I did a couple of years ago. Somehow ran away from my glasses.
Yes. And then I spent the entire afternoon on my hands and knees trying to find my eyeglasses and didn't find them. And I'm operating sans eyeglasses and really fretting. It's like losing a limb.
Well, I think you were pretty brave to go into the hive today because it wasn't that warm out. I think we had a high, around 49 degrees today?
Yeah, it was cold. But at least it was sunny and they had full sun, but they were not happy to see me.
Yeah.
Even with smoke, they chased me around. But I didn't get stung, and I spent three or four times going back out there on my hands and knees, literally crawled through the entire bee yard looking for my glasses and never found them. So I get to go try it again tomorrow, and I will combine those hives. So local hive report, there's nothing else. The rest of the hives were actually flying. Were your stuff flying today, Bob?
Yeah, actually some more than others. I was surprised. Even the little nukes, that's what always surprises me. You know, they're some of the most active hives that I have. And, you know, I've got about seven or eight nukes right now. I haven't quite buttoned them up for the winter. I'm going to hope to get out there tomorrow and do that. But they fly as much as some of the bigger hives. It's amazing.
And you have you could go into your local hive report. You have some new family there on the property.
Yeah, so I bought some used top bar hives because, as you know, I have one little top bar on my patio in the back, and I really was looking to get something more full sized. But that little one really amazes me. It's been through just about every winter. It winters over. Haven't treated it in a few years now. It swarmed this year. I caught it right before it did, and I made, I think, five nukes out of the swarm cells that I found in there. So anyway, unfortunately, I don't really have the equipment to make my own top bars. So I just happened to see on the Yahoo site that someone was selling some hives because they were moving to North Carolina. So I sent an email. We hooked up. and now the proud owner of four new top bars.
That's really cool. One of them is operational, right? The other three are not?
Yeah, one actually, he had bees in it, and he said to me, you know, there's only a couple of frames of bees in here. I'll just let you have it with the top bar. So I took it home, and when I opened it up, there were more than just a couple frames of bees, and actually there was quite a bit of honey. There was three or four frames of full frames of honey. So I put it into one of the top bars, and I've been doing some work on them, fixing them up. They needed a little work here and there. I painted them. So what I want to do tomorrow is go out and put them in the top bar that I painted and take the one that's not painted, bring it in so I can work on that over the winter.
Yeah, I think our warm days are few and far between, right? We're really getting into those days where the high is about 50 degrees at best. And I don't know if you've been watching the news, the huge storm over Alaska is pushing into Canada and it's going to push the cold air down over top of us next week.
Yeah, I think those nice, warmish 60-degree days are over.
There was one forecast, I think, for the middle of the week next week, and then it's supposed to just drop.
Yeah. Going to be really cold again next weekend. So if I don't get out there tomorrow, it's not going to get done.
Yeah, me too. If I don't get out there, and of course, I have two agendas tomorrow. So, all right, local hive report done. Let's see if we can get into segment number one. So for segment number one, this one I call Wait, What? And it is the title of the episode. A memo was released on October 15th from the Office of the Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention and the U.S. EPA. The Biologic and Economic Analysis Division analyzed neonic seed treatments for insect control on soybeans and found, quote, that these seed treatments provide negligible overall benefits to soybean production in most situations, end quote. The published data indicated that most cases there is no difference in soybean yield when soybean seed was treated with neonics versus not receiving any insect control treatment. And furthermore, it goes on to say neonicotinoid seed treatments as currently applied are only bioactive in soybean foliage for a period within the first 3 to 4 weeks of planting, which does not overlap with typical periods of activity for some of the target pest concerns. The memo appears to be based on collected evidence and a survey of 20 growers when you read through it. Data is from the North Central IPM Center, NCIPMC is the acronym for that, and it was collected through a questionnaire and additional unpublished data on neonicotinoid seed treatment efficacy, target pests, and benefits from national research and extension experts on a number of crops. For the soybean portion, this is probably important for our listeners to know where it falls. The questionnaire effort, 21 respondents representing 17 states, Iowa, Indiana, Kansas, Louisiana, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, Mississippi, North Carolina, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Texas, and Virginia submitted responses. So I'll stop there and say, Bob, really, can you scratch your head on this one?
This was really eye-opening to me. One thing that struck me, Kevin, is, well, they're saying that basically the neonics are on there as a prophylactic treatment because it lasts 3 to 4 weeks, and the bugs that they're trying to kill really don't start eating up the plants until much later. But the thing that I found most interesting was how hard it was for most farmers to buy non-GMO or non-treated seeds. I think the percentage was something like 45%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It said most growers, which in their terms were about 65% of them, indicated that they were not after any specific target insect pests for the protection. They're really using it as a prophylactic. And the seed treatments are really only effective at killing the aphids, which is what I guess their primary target is. The aphids are active in a soybean field during the 3 to 4 week period of bioactivity. So they plant this thing in the ground with the seed treatment, and the window that the neonic expresses itself is when the aphids are not there. That makes no sense whatsoever. And then you're right. What it said is 45% of the responders to the survey indicated that they have trouble buying seeds that are not coated. They can't get them, or they're hard to find. That's just, again, as beekeepers, after all the noise from CCD and these neonics, this is just an incredible outcome.
Well, the worst part, Kevin, is so they're putting the neonics on and they're planting the seeds with these systemic pesticides, and then they're spraying anyway. So you've got the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
One thing, if you said, okay, well, and this was an argument that I would always make, I try to be balanced and look at it and say, okay, so the neonics are systemic pesticides, so you put it on the seed and it stays within the plant, and at least you're not spraying 3 or 4 or 5 or more times per year. But what this article is telling me is it's not like the neonics are a substitute for spraying. They're in addition to spraying.
Yeah. That's right. And one of the things they also said about this is that if they're looking for some other thing, maybe they're trying to get fungicide or something, they can't decouple them. It's sold as a package deal. A grower purchasing a seed treated with a particular fungicide may have no choice but to purchase the neonic that's bundled with it on the same lot of seeds.
Yeah. Well, we know we're finding a lot more about fungicides and the effect on bees. You wouldn't think it, but it looks like the fungicides, which are actually a type of pesticide, if you think about it, they also have some negative effects on the bees.
So there's probably pest incursions that could warrant seed treatments, right? We should be fair to the farmers who are using this stuff. Some of them actually do have pest problems, depending on their locale and how it works. But like beekeepers shouldn't be putting insecticides in a box of insects unless they have a specific target to go after, prophylactically this makes no sense, and hopefully the industry will respond to this and stop doing it, or pressures will come from the EPA. The one thing, Bob, that was called out throughout the article is the economic benefit of not doing this. And if there's anything that will steer behavior, is that they could save a lot of money if these pesticides, the neonics, were not bundled with the seed packages.
Yeah, and the whole point of the article is yields were the same with or without the neonics. So you're spending extra money, if you will, to buy the treated seed, and you're not really seeing any benefit in terms of output.
Yeah. This was the conclusion from the memo. It says, given that much of the reported seed treatment usage in the U.S. on soybeans is not associated with a target pest, BEED, which is the name of the organization, concludes that much of the observed use is preventative and may not currently be providing any actual pest management benefits. In cases where pest pressures do not necessitate some type of insect control, efficacious alternatives are available for the key foliar pests of soybeans at a comparable cost per acre. And, you know, Bob, you and I chatted with this before we came on air here, and where does corn sit in this world, right? Is somebody doing this same study for corn?
Yeah, well, they suggested in this article that they should, but I guess it hasn't been done yet.
Yeah, I really hope that this will be an eye-opener to do that, and how ironic would it be that one of the things really detrimental to the bees would turn out to be completely useless for plant protection.
Yeah, the other thing that really bothers me about it, Kevin, is that the farmers, even if they want untreated seed, are having a hard time finding it. So that almost says to me that the market is being manipulated by the large chemical companies so that they can sell more of their treated seed. No, and I try to be balanced in all of this when you read these, but what else does that tell you if they can't find untreated seed?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, too, is that you know, I too want to be balanced and give the benefit of the doubt. When a company chooses a methodology, maybe it's too costly to produce different variants, and, you know, it's just easier to run it through and put everything on it than it is to try and build this lot and this SKU and that SKU.
But, yeah, it could be. It might be.
But at some point, when data turns around and shows that it's something you shouldn't be putting in because it provides no value and there's a cost impact to it, it's got to go away.
Yeah. Hopefully before it's too late.
So we'll provide a link to the show notes to this article, and might as well give out the website address, www.bkcorner.org. If you want to look at our show notes, every segment that we have, every thing that we provide links to is there. And you could come back and listen to different segments in the podcast by looking at the time we put this segment starts here and ends there. So go ahead and take a visit to our website and get that information. Might as well get this out of the way, too. If you have any questions, you could send a message for the podcast to kevin@bkcorner.org. So let's get over to segment number two. Segment number two, I call the Queen Comment. I received an email so long ago from Shane Wernsing, a Minnesota beekeeper. He questioned the guidance about changing out queens that are more than 2 years old. He had a valid point to wonder about advocating replacement while also promoting the notion of raising local queens that we talk about so often on the program. I don't think these two things are in conflict, so to speak, and I want to have a conversation with you, Bob, about this. First off, let's go with the notion, and for those who are new to the podcast or haven't picked up on this yet, one of the things that I believe, and you and I have talked about this a couple times, is that when a queen bee gets to her second or third year, she tends to conk out. I just have not seen any bees with longevity, especially the bees that are coming from the packages coming out of the South or California.
It's really amazing, Kevin, that even the package bees are being superseded in the first year. So to expect them to be productive into the second and third year is really a stretch.
So it just comes to notion, and this is by sheer experience with beekeepers, and maybe you can corroborate me on this, is that first year, if they get through and they don't have a dud queen, they do okay. They come out of the second year, they have a pretty good run through to about June or August, and then that hive doesn't overwinter. Or if it does overwinter, the third year is the death march for the thing. Very few people are starting brand new packages and making it through to the third year without some sort of problem. And I think it's directly attributed to two things. One is a buildup of varroa in a hive. Eventually, it's going to get to critical mass, and if it's not managed or culled in some way. And the other one is just the viability of the queen. And we keep hearing in the industry, listen to EAS, listen to ABF, listen to different podcasts and scientists speaking locally to us, all saying the same thing. There's something's wrong with the queen quality generally.
Now, even if you think back to when queens were, say, better than they are today, there still were an awful lot of beekeepers, particularly the commercial guys, that would requeen late in the summer going into the fall. So they had a good, young, vigorous queen, first of all, raising the winter bees in the fall, and then coming out of the winter in what I guess would be their second season, which seems to be the most productive. So it's not something that's new. I think there really is a lot to be said for having a young, vigorous queen going into the winter.
Yeah, and if you listen to some of the talks that you and I have exchanged, I know I shared some of the ABF past conference talks, especially the some for Dave Tarpey, who's coming to see us at our meeting in the spring. He's saying bigger is better for a queen and that they are just not lasting. They have evidence of this. And so let's talk about this one notion. And you and I know because we've done this. You can raise local queens and replace your queens without literally pinching a queen. And specifically, the way you're doing this is you're doing splits and you're pulling eggs out and you're putting them in, but you're doing a false positive here, right? Because you're forcing them to pick eggs. And the thing that I keep hearing on some of these recordings is that they're going to pick eggs that are 1, 2, maybe even 3 days old. And the older the egg, the faster it emerges. The older the egg, the poorer the queen. And if the first queen emerges and the colony does not keep her from overtaking and giving a chance to the better quality queens that came from the younger larvae, which that is the study data, right? The younger queens, the ones that are made from the day-old eggs versus the 2 or 3 day egg, are better quality. That third day queen is the first one to emerge, and she goes around and kills all of them, and then you lowering your queen stock. I'm of the notion, Bob, that I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to do splits where I'm letting them raise their own queen. I'm going to let them get to swarm state and pull out swarm cells that they made with the full intention and probably made with young 1 day old eggs in a perfect scenario.
Well, I think that's really ideal, Kevin, and I don't think there's any reason that you can't do it. It just means that you need to be in the hives earlier in the season, during swarm season, and you need to go in every week. And when you see those swarm cells, you need to take advantage of them. You know, we built a queen castle, so if you find queen cells, you can raise 4 queens in a queen castle. You can put them into a nuke. It just doesn't make any sense to me when I hear people say, well, I went in the hive, I found queen swarm cells, and I eliminated all the swarm cells. To me, those are free queens and good queens on top of that, and I just can't see pinching them to try to prevent the hive from swarming. Why not use them? They are good quality queens. It just takes a little bit extra equipment, so make a queen castle, buy some nukes, and take advantage of that.
Yeah, so in this context, and going back to what Shane had said, he's absolutely right. We want to maintain our local stock, and I think this is the way to do it. So if you play the scenario out, the hive gets to the point where they're going to swarm. You prevent them from swarming by doing a false swarm, and you're pulling out the queen cells. You're raising them in the queen castle. And then you're taking those young queens that emerge and you're replacing your old queens in your stock colonies, but it's all from the same, it's basically without having the hive issue a swarm. And you could put the bees back, and I just think that's the right way to go. I'm going to change my tactics in the spring, and this is how I'm going to try to keep my queens vigorous.
Well, you know how lucky I got this year, right, with my top bar. I went in there, I found about 20 swarm cells, queen cells, and I took about half of them out. I made 5 nukes up, and about a week later, the top bar swarmed, and I was lucky enough to catch the swarm. So not only did I make 5 new hives out of it, or 5 new colonies, but I also got the same queen, the old queen, back.
Yeah, it's the best of both worlds.
Yeah, sometimes you get lucky, not often.
Yeah, so hopefully this answers Shane's question, and I guess the other side of it is you can let your hive swarm. That's not a bad thing to do. A lot of times that's frowned upon because you're being detrimental to your honey flow, and or, you know, you don't want your bees in somebody's eaves hanging in their garage or doing whatever. But if you're in an open area, so what? You're populating nature, and I've always thought that that's not a bad thing, necessarily.
Well, it takes a strong hive to swarm, so you must be doing something right if your bees are building up fast and want to swarm in the spring. But, you know, I think Shane is absolutely right. If you just keep popping in new queens from California, you're really not going to get anywhere. So you really do need to make your own. I think it's the easiest thing that beekeepers can do after they've been keeping bees for a year or 2 or 3 is take a crack at raising your own queens. You don't need to do grafting. You can raise them from swarm cells. You can make splits. There's a lot of different ways to do it, and the more you do it, the more comfortable you are with it. But I think you can raise a lot better queens, I think, than you can buy from packages right now. I mean, it just amazes me how many people that I hear that are telling me that their queens are being superseded in the first year from their packages.
Yeah, we hear that all the time, you and I, because we know enough new beekeepers from our region that are doing that, that consistently have that problem going on, you know. And this methodology that we're talking about is a way to keep our local survivor stock in the area, right? This is what the colony was building to survive on.
Yeah, when you think about it, you know, why is there such a great packaged bee industry? It's because people want their queens early, right? Well, if you winter queens over or winter nukes, you've got your queens in April. You got your queens in March and February, whenever you want them. And they're good quality queens. So why not raise them the summer before, middle of the summer, winter them over, and then you'll have them early in the spring, and you'll have a good, young, vigorous queen.
Agreed. And you know that we have a request from one of our members asking us to do some coverage on queen grafting and the different methodologies that I thought it would be interesting to put that together for a spring presentation and then bring that info to the podcast here.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and you can buy a lot of complicated equipment, but there really are some simple ways to do it as well, and that's what I would encourage all new beekeepers after they've been in it for a couple of years. Take a try at raising your own queens. I think you'll be glad you did.
I agree, and I too will be building a queen castle this winter and prepping for that for the spring. So, thanks, Shane, for the question. I know it was a long time ago. Hopefully, you're still following along and you got what you were looking for. If we didn't set you up, send me a note, and I'll answer any, or we'll attempt to answer any questions that still linger in your mind. But thanks for taking the time to send the question over. So those are the two segments, Bob, that we had prepped for this episode. Actually, we're going to stay on the theme of answering some listener questions or listener email. And one of them actually was one from someone named Pat. He noted that we expressed difficulty in getting bees to come drink water from an allocated source. And he came up with such a brilliant answer, so simple. The answer, Bob, is put honey out and then dilute it with water and keep diluting it until it's just water, and the bees will recognize that as a source.
When you first told me this, my first reaction was, duh, why didn't I think of that? I mean, it's really brilliant, right?
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, so I've struggled, and, you know, I've talked about this on the past. I've talked about some of your techniques with putting a little chlorine in it, and could they smell it, pinch of salt, and so on, but this is just brilliant, you know, that makes complete sense. I have to wonder if it will attract other critters, like my open feeding station that I tried that one time. I had everything there, wasps and hornets and European hornets and whatever, but I have to say this is just really smart. I'm going to do this first thing in the spring.
And I think, too, the problem you had, Kevin, was later in the summer, right, when there were a lot more of these guys around. I think early in the year you probably could get away with it. But, I mean, it's just, it sounds foolproof. It really does.
It does. And it's so simple, it's not difficult whatsoever. And you're right, when I did it, it was a time of year where they didn't have anything to eat, and I was basically opening up the Las Vegas buffet.
All you can eat.
Yeah.
So thanks, Pat. That was a great idea. And sometimes the simpler ones are the best.
Yep, agreed. Yeah, thank you, Pat, for that. Appreciate it. So the next listener question is from Roger. He says, I have a quick question. Are you using 8 frames or 10 frame setup, plus and minuses for each? Actually, this year, Bob, I put together an 8 frame hive, and the fact of the matter is, I really like the hive. It's the same as a 10-frame to me, but I always thought that it made more sense from an A-frame because they don't use a lot of the outside, and that you can really tell the difference in the weight of that.
Mm. I would think too, for wintering, it probably would be better also than to have these empty frames on the side.
Yeah, it's just a nice box. It seems a little more adept. I don't know. I can't say that I have a ton of experience on how it's going to overwinter. I will tell you that for whatever reason, they seem to build out quicker. So I don't know. If they don't have frame one and 10 to build, maybe they'll go up quicker. So they built it out pretty quickly. But thus far, I really like it.
It's one of those things that if you don't make that decision right up front, you buy all this 10-frame equipment, and then it makes it pretty tough to switch over to the 8-frame.
Yeah, well, I made a heck of a mess this year because I have 8-frame. I went to a medium hive. I'm doing a bunch of. I went to the poly hive, which is different. I'm going the opposite direction. I have all these weird things, and I'm still contemplating a ware hive. So that'll be even worse. And I have a top bar.
It's interesting, though, that nobody recommends A-frames to beginners. You know, I never heard of it in the beginning beekeeping courses. Anybody talk about the option that, you know, if you don't want to go to 10-frame, you can go to 8. They talked about using all mediums instead of using deeps, but they really didn't mention 8-frames.
Yeah. I know the one thing that was kind of weird is you load all your equipment up for your 10-frames, and then you have to pull something out special for the 8-framer. So it has a different size inner cover, roof is different, and the bottom is different, and the feeder was different. And then I had to take a mouse guard for a 10-frame and cut it down because I didn't have one for the 8-frame. So if you're going to mix and match equipment, there is a little bit of management difficulty with it, but it's nothing you can't overcome. It's just something you have to know is going to be part of the game. If you started out with all 8-frame equipment, I think you would not be at a disadvantage whatsoever, though.
Yeah. Might be something we want to start recommending, or at least as an option to beginning beekeepers.
I think the other thing, too, is the 8-frame equipment, to me, when it's using full size, is more palatable than all mediums. I know that people are advocates of that, but I'm just thinking about pure comb space. You know, you have the top bar and the bottom bar, and with mediums, you're losing square footage inside the hive, and maybe that's not a big deal. Maybe it shouldn't be made a deal of, but I think more traditionally, a larger frame just provides proper space for brood and nectar and pollen storage, and they're getting shortcutted a little bit with all mediums. But, you know, look, if the difference between maintaining hives is the ability to lift a medium versus a 8-frame because they're probably a little bit lighter, then by all means, don't forego going the medium route.
Well, that's one point, but the other is you need twice as many frames or nearly twice as many, and who wants to be making all those frames for mediums? Now, I know your most recent purchase, you bought them already made, and that's the way to go because it's tedious making frames, even
with
a frame jig.
I agree with you. Although the upcharge nowadays to buy pre-built frames is so worth the time if your time is worth money to you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there's not a bad recommendation. I don't know that I should try and point out a favorite, but if I had my preference, I think an 8-frame would be my preference.
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head, is just that it's not really standard, quote-unquote, and therefore you may have to improvise a little here and there because you might not be able to find all the equipment that you need to fit an 8-framer, but that's not a big obstacle to overcome.
Yeah, especially those that are listening now. It's November, and if they're in the United States and they want to start next year, they could start with 8-frames and be good to go, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the other thing Roger said is, would you mind if I email you my beekeeping plans with some questions? I don't know if that's irrelevant anymore, Roger, but by all means, feel free. And hopefully some of you have seen some of my email responses. even if you wrote me a long time ago, I've been trying to do my best to get back to some emails. Bob, you would not believe, somehow my email address got on a spam thing, and just all of a sudden I was getting 100 emails a day, and the listener emails got lost in between, and I had to go set my email to be most aggressive, but it was so tedious to go through the couple thousand messages and find the listener messages in there. But I think I got a good handle on it now.
Yeah. It can be so aggravating.
Yeah, email is just, it's so done. It should go away, I think. There has to be a better way. All right, let's go to our next topic here.
So I recognize, Bob, that I'm just killing the audio here talking on the phone. So I switched to a headset, and hopefully this will make us a little bit more even in our, I won't drown you out, and you'll come up a little better. The next thing is from a listener called Bob Kloss out of Reddington, New Jersey. You know that guy? It's about a bear platform. You sent me some pictures over that are really, really cool.
So, well, as you know, I receive a number of different beekeeping newsletters, and one of them I get is from Spikenard Farm, which is a honeybee sanctuary. So they try to just really make a home for bees. So they've landscaped it. Anyway, they try a lot of different things. They've got lots of volunteers there. And one of the things I saw was something they're just trying this year. It's called the Bear Platform. So they build a platform to put their beehives on, but the difference is that they set the legs under the platform, and the theory behind it is that the bears can't just climb up the legs like they can when they're on the outside, so they're forced to do a pull-up in order to get up on the platform. And because of their low center of gravity, they can't pull themselves up. So kind of interesting. So there's the platform. The poor bear is looking at the bees, but he can't pull himself up to get them. So, an alternative to an electric fence.
Yeah. And I'm loathing building an electric fence. I didn't get mine up this year, and I'm still playing roulette. Third year in a row, Bob, I'm playing with this. But That seems pretty extreme to build a platform, but if you're in bear territory, that makes complete sense.
Yeah, well, you know, you'd have your own deck out there, Kevin. Go sit on the deck with your bees.
Yeah. In my luck, I'd fall off the deck. How do they get up and down on that?
So, well, they have a portable ladder. They have a little wooden ladder that they put up against the platform, and I'm sure they take it away when they're done. But I'm not sure if this is really practical if you've got more than a couple of hives. But if you're a little backyard beekeeper and you've got two or maybe four, probably is a lot cheaper than building an electric fence.
If you think about what the cost was, and let me tell you, I looked at it for the area. You could almost build it for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I wanted to ask you is, out by your bee yard, what do you think about putting a cabinet up or a table? You ever think about that? I've been thinking about that somehow.
A table? Well, you know, I've actually read around some people will put an old aquarium stand out there just to be able to put boxes on and make some of the lifting and up and down, bending over a little bit easier. Is that what you're talking about?
So funny you should say that. It's right behind me. It's a 55-gallon fish tank. It has fish and stuff in it, but it's sitting on a metal stand. And
mm-hmm.
I had two of them, and we gave the other one away, and I could take this metal stand and put it out. That's exactly what I was going to put out in the yard. And I was going to move the wooden one that I had my spare under this fish tank in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to move this out and make a table out of it.
Yeah. Well, think about it. You know, if you go look around at yard sales, you might be able to pick one up pretty easily.
You know, I have that big industrial platform out there where I have my top bar sitting on, and I actually have another one of those that my father-in-law had brought home to the property sitting out behind the shed, so I could have two of those. But those things are huge.
Yeah, they're pretty big.
Yeah, so maybe in the spring I'll be building a bear platform. Maybe that's something we could consider for the New Jersey, the Northwest New Jersey thing, if they'd let us build one of those in the park.
Yeah, could be. You know, the other thing that you can do is I found this little platform ladder. I don't know if I've showed it to you. It's about 2 feet high, and it's about probably 4 feet long and a couple feet wide. And they run a sale on them every year on Black Friday, either Lowe's or Home Depot, and they sell them for about $17 or $18. So last year I found out about the Black Friday sale, and I hunted around. I finally tracked one down. But that's the whole idea behind this, is that when you lift the boxes off, you're not having to put them all the way down to the ground. You're putting them basically at knee level, so you're not bending over all the way down and up again. So on Black Friday, take a look. It'll be either Lowe's or Home Depot, and they'll have a special, because I think they're normally priced around $45. So $17 or $18 is a pretty good deal. And they're aluminum, so they're not going to rust.
How wide do they spread out?
The width, not the length. They're about, well, they're big enough to put a nuke on, hangs over a little bit. I'd say probably about 14, maybe 15 inches. They're not that wide.
Yeah, that's perfect. They're like a painting ladder.
Yeah, well, exactly. And actually, I'm going to put my top bar on it now, because I put all the nukes together in my little nuke condo. You know what I do in the winter. And I think I'm going to put the top bar on this, because I haven't really figured out how I'm going to get these top bars up off the ground. That's one of my winter projects.
You could always build it out of PVC, Bob.
Listen, there's plenty of ideas at Home Depot, right, Kevin?
Yep, a modified BK corner hive stand. Right, cool. I'm gonna take a look for those. Black Friday right around the corner. In fact, I don't know if you noticed, they're starting to sell stuff already.
Yeah.
Since Halloween is over, Black Friday is on.
Well, you know, it's gonna be Thanksgiving in a couple of weeks, and then it's right around the corner after that.
I have some days to burn. In fact, I put all my days in for the rest of the year, and I still have some left over. So I was still contemplating some notion of going out to California for the American Beekeepers Federation, but I don't know how I'm going to pay for it. Maybe I ought to do a Kickstarter. See if somebody will crowdsource me out there.
That's in the beginning of January, right?
Yeah, and I could carry my days over to the first half of January, and I'd have days to go. Taking the week off for Thanksgiving, and I already have my bee projects planned. I'm going to build a couple stands, and I'm going to build the queen castle and stuff that we talked about.
Oh, that's one thing I wanted to tell you, actually, and just to digress a little bit. But you mentioned to me that you wanted to build another top bar.
Yeah.
So I got an email today from the guy that I bought the top bars from, and he actually found the plans for the Golden Mean top bar, and he's going to send them to me.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so once I get them, I'll share them with you, and you can build a Golden Mean hive.
Yeah, so why don't we go into that, actually? The next topic is about foundationless. So you were going to talk about Golden Mean. Go ahead and explain that, because you were mentioning this to me, and I was curious as to what we thought that was. And I have an idea, by the way.
Okay. Well, when I first contacted this fella about the hives, he mentioned to me that they were built according to the Golden Mean plans. And so I Googled Golden Mean Hive, and it pops up to Corwin Bell, I guess, who is the one who made this original hive. But the idea behind it, it's sometimes called the golden ratio, I found out. But the idea is that the proportions are such that they are naturally occurring in nature, and the hive, therefore, is supposed to be more productive because it's built to these specific proportions. He was also saying how a lot of things in nature also are made to these proportions, and some of the greatest artwork and architecture that we have is also built to the golden mean. So there's something kind of metaphysical about it, that there's something inherently positive or beneficial to this this ratio. So I don't know, that was my take on it.
That sounds like a bee hugger theory.
Something like that.
I want to say it was in the first 10 episodes I covered something about the way that bees build comb, and specifically it's not unlike the way that if you held two ends of a rope and let it hang, it would create a natural arch.
Uh-huh.
And something leads me to believe that that was the golden mean. This sounds so familiar to me. I could be full of soup, but I seem to think that that's true. And, you know, so one of the topics we had queued up next is foundationless. And one of my 2015 objectives is to go foundationless in the brood chamber. And I'm curious what you think about, I know you're doing it. How much of the brood chamber can be foundationless? Do you think it's advantageous to have every other frame or the whole thing? What is your experience with that, since you have some experience with this?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't see any reason why you can't go completely foundationless in the brood chamber. The key is getting them to draw one nice straight comb, and then once they get one going, they'll build more. But you kind of have to keep an eye on it, especially in a top bar hive. Now, I know you're going to do it in Langs, but in a top bar hive, if they start cross-combing and you don't get to it right away, you're going to lose a lot of comb, and you're going to have to straighten it all out. But, you know, one thing that I find is that the nukes will really draw out foundationless really perfectly and quickly, and with mostly worker brood or worker comb in it. So, the other thing, it's interesting, I looked at this top bar, because the one that I bought, you saw it, it's about 5 feet long.
Yeah.
And it's got a lot of bars with comb, and they're all drawn out almost perfectly. But what I find is, in the brood chamber, it's obviously, it's all worker comb. But then as you start getting out, before they start putting honey in it, you've got a combination of worker and brood comb on the same frames. And then, of course, as it goes out to the back, now you've got just your nectar and honey frames. But
wait, when you said worker and brood, did you mean worker and drone?
I'm sorry, yes, worker and drone, yes. There were three or four of them like that, where half of it was worker and half of it was drone.
Yeah. I noticed in the observation hives and in the mentoring hives that we have that the foundationless frames that you put in there, since you started that practice up at our mentoring yard, they would build what would be worker comb from the top edge down through two-thirds to almost three-quarters to the bottom bar. They would put drone around the bottom, and the drone would circulate up about halfway through to the sides, and then sometimes it would go all the way up to the top bar. But I noticed there was like a halo, reverse halo, on the bottom of the frame where they put their drone. And to me, I think some of the stuff that we're messing up is we're putting all foundation and they're building worker comb, and then they're putting the drone on the outside. And I have to wonder if you went natural. And this is a question I have for you. You just made an interesting comment. They tend to build worker brood in nukes, and you're going to take that out and put it in a full-size colony. Are we manipulating? Is this the way nature would intend a full-size colony to build? Would it be better to try and get them to do their foundationless in the full-size colony so that they build it more akin to the description of the frame that we just said? Or when you move something that's foundationless from a nuke and you put it in a full-size colony, they'll restructure that frame on the bottom and build drone brood. I don't I don't see him rebuilding cells that way.
Yeah, I don't either. You know what I find with foundationless is that if you put a foundationless frame in the brood nest, they don't like that extra space there. And there's something different about it having a piece of foundation in it and just being foundationless. But when you put that foundationless comb in the middle of the brood nest, they build that thing out like within a couple of days because they just don't like that space in the middle of the brood nest. So that's kind of how I use my nukes, is to make these foundationless brood combs, and they draw them out really quickly.
I would love to be able to go foundationless with a brand new 10 frame and see how they build it, and then let them go foundationless in a nuke and put it in a 10 frame artificially and see if they change it around. I wish, you know, if we were a full-time researcher, we'd probably be able to know these things. Somebody has to know the answer to this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, the whole point of foundationless is they're going to build what they need and what they want, right? And I guess they're going to build different things at different times of the year. You know, when they need drones, they're going to build drones. They're going to build drone comb. When they're building up in the spring, they're going to build worker comb.
This is a bee-hugger notion, but I would like them to build it just as if they were in a tree. I know that's a novel concept, right? But I think if they started in a full-size box, that would be closer to the dimension, and if they started from scratch, they would build it foundationless. If they built straight, not wonky comb, they would set those frames up with a mix. I don't think that they would do what we tend to see, which is put drone code completely to the outside.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I do. I think the other thing you'll notice when you go foundationless is you're going to see different size cells, not just drone and worker, but different size worker cells. But in the middle of the brood nest, they always seem to be a little bit smaller. Now, I haven't measured them, and, you know, I don't know whether small cell works or it doesn't work. I'm really not even commenting on that. It's just that what I found is when I originally started going foundationless and I started looking at the top bar, I thought that they would build, you know, the larger cells, 5.4, 5.2, and then gradually they would regress and they would all be, you know, smaller, 4.9 or whatever.
Right.
But what I find is that in the top bars and in the foundationless, there's a variety of sizes. The bees build a lot of different size cells. They're not all the same 4.9 or 5.1 or 5.4. They're different sizes, and I don't know why, but I figure the bees know what they're doing, and they know what they want.
I hear on some of the recordings that I listen to that smaller bees emerge faster. And to me, if smaller bees emerge faster, that is a Varroa deterrent, and that's why people are espousing small cell. I have to wonder, I don't have any practical experience, if you left the bees on foundationless over time, would they get to a smaller cell? You know, Bob, we could throw on the pile here that conversation you and I had when we went to the state meeting about culling comb and the fact that if you left your old comb in there, the cocoons would make the cell get smaller and smaller. And it also has the other impacts. It's got brood pheromone, smell, and other impacts. And, you know, there's some saying that this recommendation to keep culling your comb out is actually maybe not a good idea. It was one of the prominent researchers I listened to, and I don't remember which one, so I'm not going to take a guess at it, that said he knows that people are recommending to cull your comb out to get rid of all the stuff, but he sees it differently. He thinks that's the engine that runs the hive and the chemicals and how important that is, and he's actually saying, I hear what people are saying, but I have stuff that I will treasure. It's 15-year-old comb, and I'm not getting rid of it.
Yeah. Well, I just found out something this week. I saw an article, actually. It was I think it was a PhD dissertation, and he was talking about how the bees control humidity in the hive. And I think I knew that, right? They try to maintain 50 or 60% so they can raise the brood. But the one thing that I found that I didn't know was he was saying that the cocoons, the old cocoons in the older brood comb, actually act as reservoirs or sinks for moisture. And so they absorb the moisture, and when the hive starts becoming too dry, they actually release moisture to maintain that 50%. I think I've always known that bees maintain humidity in the hive, but I think of it as, well, it's too humid, so I see them fanning outside, and they're bringing the humidity down. But I never thought about, well, how do they bring the humidity up? And again, going back to this old dark black brood comb that's got all of these cocoons, and they actually absorb water and release water when the hive needs it.
Yeah, you shared that with me. It came from Pretoria University. The name of it is Homeostasis, Humidity, and Water Relations in Honeybee Colonies. I don't have a link to it. You shared the document to me, but we could probably find that and put it in the show notes. It was from November 2008, and it was written by someone named Michael B. Ellis. And I agree. That's something that I had never heard before. But it stands to reason. You think about honey in the hive being hygroscopic, and I think you hear Michael Bush talk about the fauna in the hive and all of the bacteria and so on, and I do believe that this old comb plays a role in it. There was another researcher that said recently, and maybe you heard this in one of the podcasts that I shared, is that the average life of a hive is 6 to 7 years, even in nature. Do you remember that statement?
That was Tom Seeley who said that. That the feral colonies that he found in the Arnott Forest, that was their lifespan. So they lived for 5 or 6, and then they died, and another swarm would move in.
But you would think they're using the same comb, right?
Your
point.
Yep.
Yeah, very interesting.
Let me quote this. I'm looking at the article now. So it says, this is the gist of it right here, and this is a quote. Cocoons that are spun by the larva accumulate in cells, and these hygroscopic cocoons contribute to passive stabilization of humidity. Old comb containing cocoons absorb 11% of its own mass in water when placed in high humidity, and this water can readily evaporate into the atmosphere when humidity decreases. This buffering effect may increase brood survivorship by maintaining a high and stable humidity in the brood cells. That's pretty interesting.
You have to wonder if that moisture plays a role in what grows in the cell and potentially in the development of the larvae, too.
Well, there's that, and then also, what about the microclimate in the cell, right? The fungi that are growing in there, the bacteria that's in there, the beneficial bacteria I'm talking about, right? So that moisture, I'm sure, helps that as well.
And they put royal jelly in the cell, and if the cell has a moist environment, maybe it's not evaporating, and some of that dynamic also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a neat thing to learn. I never contemplated that when you told me about that. Again, there's always something new to be considered, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty interesting. That's what I love about beekeeping, Kevin. You can never learn it all. There's always something new.
So let's go into our next topic, which is scale data. You were monitoring all year and provided us with some insights on this. You want to go through what you learned?
Yeah, sure. So in the spring, we picked up a couple of old grain scales, and I set mine up, and I put one of my my better hives on it. And so that started around the beginning of May, and I would go out every Saturday and take a reading. So it was interesting. I guess the idea, what I hoped to get out of it, was to see exactly when the nectar flow was on and when it was over, just by measuring whether the hive was gaining or losing weight. You know, as a new beekeeper, you hear the old veteran beekeepers talk about, well, the flow is on or it's not on, and how do you really know? I think one of the best ways to know is the hive gaining weight or is it losing weight?
Yeah.
So I go out every week and take a reading. And I guess what the takeaway that I saw is if you look at the numbers, in May 17th, it gained 7 pounds. May 24th, it gained 21 pounds. May 31st, 12.5 pounds. June, the first week in June, 9 pounds, and then 1 pound. So I always thought that the main flow here in New Jersey was, well, mostly the month of June, stop maybe the first or second week in July. And what this is saying to me is that the main flow is in, this year at least, was in May.
In May.
And, you know, maybe we're not supering early enough. You know, I think back
to
those...
that rings a bell to me, Bob.
Really?
Yeah, for the new listeners, Bob and I had this conversation about cracking open the hives in April, and you thought I was nuts.
Yep. Well, that's my other project for this year is I track bloom dates. So, but as I was tracking bloom dates, I pulled this out and I looked, and I have a note here, says first drones, cap drones, was on April 26th, and the first drones that were flying was on May 3rd. And I remember we had a pretty spirited discussion last year,
because
you wanted to be making splits in April. Your reasoning was, well, we make the split now, and it takes a couple weeks to raise a queen, and by the time the queen is out, you're going to have drones.
Yep.
And I kept saying, that's pretty risky. What if you don't? You're going to get a queen that's not well mated. And then I go back to my own notes, and it says, hey, the drones were flying on May 3rd.
May 3rd.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
Well, and the thing about this, right, and the takeaway, I think you and I discussed this in the past because it's deja vu to me. The earlier you can make your splits, the more of the forage is available for that split to recover and get built. Because if you do your split late in the season, and you just said May is the time frame where the forage is on, if you look at your notes, your hives were gaining until the first week in July, and then they started losing. And what's interesting to me is, I see your low number here is 106 pounds. Your high number is 167. That's 60 pounds. That's like a kid.
Yeah. It's actually pretty amazing. But you know, you're right. So look at that. I made some splits, made some nukes, right around the beginning of June. And if you think about it, you know, you make those splits. If you make them in June, they only have a couple of weeks of the main flow, and then all of a sudden there's nothing out there for them. And it really, it bears out in that those nukes that I made up, they never really did gain enough weight to winter over, so I had to feed them.
Yeah.
So, can I say you're right?
I got lucky.
Yeah,
next year it'll probably be a late... We had a reasonable spring, right? You know, it's funny because the growth, the combination of the things that you put together, right? The weight and the bloom dates. And one of our objectives this year, and you did so much better than I did because I didn't have any bees, you have really good notes here to work from. And next year, you could look and say, well, when did the snowdrops come out? And if they're trailing a week, I think it's pretty steady that you'll be a week behind. And we see it shift a week forward and a week back. I've noticed that since I've been a beekeeper. And I have that in my notes. I'm sure you do too, right? You could tell when... So the big thing for me is when the forsythia blooms, It's usually the first week of soccer season, which is the same weekend every week, every year. But I've seen that move forward a week, and I've seen that trail a week to the first first week of soccer, so to speak, right? So
yeah, I think I see the same thing with the dandelions, right? So you get the dandelions, they're either at that middle or up to the end of April, and they vary, it varies by a week. Sometimes it's, you know, the 18th or the 19th of April. Other years it's 26th, 27th. I very rarely have I seen it before that, although we did have that one really warm early spring. That was a couple of years ago. But you're right, it varies by a week or so, usually. That's about all.
We have to take a look at your, another time, your growing degree days. And I'm curious what Charlie tracked, because I'm guessing he tracked it too, right?
I don't know if he did or he didn't, but he talked a lot about it.
I mean,
that's the key right there. So if you, the guy, the idea behind the growing degree days is plants are going to bloom at within a certain range of growing degree days, which is a measure of how much heat we've had, cumulative measure of heat during the season. So, for example, when I look at my bloom dates here, let's go, I see snowdrops. They were out on March 22nd. Well, there was zero growing degree days at that point. So they basically, they come out in the winter, right? But then if you look at, let's go down, dandelions. So the dandelions, the first ones I saw were on April 19th, and there were 57 and a half growing degree days. They were in full bloom about a week later at 75 growing degree days. So the idea is that I should be able to, next year, predict when the dandelions are going to bloom based on the growing degree days that we have so far that year. According to this, they're going to bloom somewhere between, let's say, 55 to 75 growing degree days. And that's the whole idea of tracking this, is to try to predict, you know, are we behind, are we ahead, and when things are going to bloom. Unfortunately, it's a large range for all these different flowers. So it's not like you can say, well, it's going to bloom at 100 growing degree days. It's usually, well, it blooms somewhere between 100 and 300. So it's not all that accurate, but it gives you an idea of when to expect it.
You have to wonder, if we looked at these, if we could somehow figure out where the good pollen is and say, could you get your bees to match to that good pollen so when they're ready to go, they go find the good pollen, and better fed bees are healthier colonies, right?
Yeah, as we're finding out. I mean, I think as a new beekeeper, the first couple of years, I don't think I really understood how important that pollen is, to have good pollen, not just pollen coming in, but good pollen coming in to keep the bees healthy and to make the brood healthy.
So you had a link here for the growing degree days calculator on weather.com. It's weather.com/outdoors/agriculture. I can never say that word well. /growing-degree-days. And
that's my zip code at the end.
You could go figure that out by putting in your location, and it'll give you information about that. So we've talked about this before on the show. It's an interesting concept to follow.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, with this calculator, you can go back and you can say, well, on March 30th, we had 50 growing degree days this year, and you can go back and look at, well, what was it last year? And they also will give you the average over all the years. What's the average growing degree day on March 30th? So I think the more you track it, probably the more useful it is. But I'm glad I took at least a first crack at it this year.
Yeah, you did. You did a really good job, from what I could see. And I don't even know what half these plants are. How the heck do you know what they were?
Well, that's because they're in my yard, you know. So like the top one, Helleborus, is something that my my wife plants, and it comes up very, very early. Lesser celandine, I had no idea what it was. I went down by the brook behind my house, and I found all these yellow flowers blooming in April. What else? Things like that. So I saw them, and then I said, well, I have to find out what this is, because it's blooming now.
Were the bees on it, or, I mean, is everything in here, the bees were on it?
The celandine, yes, they were on that. Yeah, it's like, you know, yes, they're on. They've been on everything that's on that list. Even the jewelweed this year. Remember I told you that? I have jewelweed in the back of my yard because I have a little swampy area by the brook. And for years, the bees never touched it. And I was disappointed because when I first started beekeeping, I thought, well, I got all this jewelweed. This will be great. It blooms late in the season. The bees are going to love it. Never touched it. And then last year, for the first time, the bees were all over it. And they were all over it again this year. And I don't know whether it's just that they found it.
They don't touch ours.
Yeah.
We have tons and tons of it.
So you know what I think? I don't think it's their preference. I think if there's something better, they'll go for it. But evidently when there's nothing else out there, they'll settle for jewelweed. Because we were talking to Stan Wasatowski, and he said the same thing. He's never seen bees on his jewelweed.
You know what I see on here is wild mustard. That stuff just grows everywhere. I think that's what gives us our honey a lemony taste.
Oh, yours especially. Remember you had that really lemony tasting honey? Yeah.
That is everywhere at that time frame, and I'm pretty confident that that's what a lot of the bee forage is that time of year, and I don't know if you ever, you just walk out and grab the leaves off of that and eat it. It's really, really good.
Oh, yeah? Never done that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just looking at this, too, that's an early bloomer, so that was the end of April. It was in full bloom the second of May. And you're right, it's all over the place.
The thing that kills me is when they do these Roundup-ready fields, they spray all that stuff
and
kill it down. I tried to talk to the guy next to me and say, can you hold off until that stuff is finished blooming? And he came in a little later this year, which was good for me, but I didn't see as much of it as I have in the past. But across the county road from me, there's that one horse farm, and it's all over there, and I'm thinking the bees could get as much as they could take.
You know, it's the same thing with the dead nettle. Okay, so dead nettle is what they call a winter annual. And it grows in disturbed soil. So what happens is once the field has been left over the winter, it's the first thing that comes up in the fields. And if they plow that under right away, that's a significant source for the bees. I have a little patch of it here, and the bees are all over it because it blooms so early. But if you till the field, as soon as it gets warm, all that dead nettle goes away, and there's really not a whole lot for the bees at that time of year.
Yeah. Interesting stuff, Bob. We got a couple other things to go, and we're an hour and something in, so let's plug into our next topic.
Let's move on.
So the next thing I wanted to talk about was the alcohol wash containers. John Gout was... I think that's how you say his name. He was at the recent beekeepers meeting, the New Jersey beekeepers meeting with Keith Delaplane, and he sent a note over saying, you could purchase those bee shakers. These are the double peanut butter jars joined in the middle that you use to do mite counts from Propolis Etc. catalog that comes out of Quebec, Canada, and it's propolis-etc.ca. www.propolis-etc.ca. Go there, and you could see the catalog. The bee shakers are on page 72. And Bob, I sent you over this catalog and told you to go take a look at it. We're the gadget guys, right? There's a lot of cool things in this. Did you go take a look?
Oh, they really are. As a matter of fact, I just opened it up again, Kevin, and I'm looking at this, what do they call it, a queen? Some sort of a queen castle? It's just different. But yeah, it's got some really neat tools in it. What I really liked is, especially the glassware, they've got some really interesting glassware, things that are shaped in triangles, tops that fit mason jars that are painted or embossed with bees. They've got just lots of really interesting stuff.
Yeah, they have. You and I were looking at the hive covers that they have. You would think if anybody, I just did a hive cover feature in the last episode, as you know, and they have a bunch of different hive covers because that's where you use them in Canada.
Yeah, some pretty nice ones.
And the other thing that I noticed is they have different equipment than we don't. It's just different offerings. Let me see if I could find some things.
Well, one that I remember was the Dadont hive, right? I had never heard of a Dadont hive.
Yeah.
But they have it in here.
I thought the metal corners protectors were neat. I'd never seen those, and they have things that are holder corners that keep the boxes aligned. I've never seen that hardware. The different hive entrances, if you see some of those, it's on page 35. If you look at the ones that slide up and down, they're more sophisticated than the ones that I have. You've seen on my hive, different frame rests and stuff. They have some neat things. The wooden pollen trap, I don't think I've seen a bunch of those, but the one that they had in there with the band that goes up and attaches on page 36.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of different neat little things in here.
They've got everything. I mean, they've got everything for hobbyists and backyard beekeepers to full-scale production.
They sell the polyhive that I have in here. I see it advertised in a couple different things. And they also have a nuke form factor for it, which I didn't know existed.
Look at this thing. It's called the Hog Half Comb. Let's see what page I'm on, Kevin.
What's it called?
The Hog Half Comb. Let me find it. I'm trying to find out what page I'm on. Come on. 38 or 39. Take a look at that. I'm not sure I understand exactly what it does.
As you read the catalog, it's in French and English, because, of course, they speak French and English in Canada. It looks like a cut comb container device.
I guess, yeah.
And they'll build literally in the boxes.
Okay, yeah, because actually if you go to the next couple pages, there are cut comb supers.
I've seen those. If you look on the one before that, the Ross Rounds, it's a similar concept but a different approach, it looks like.
Yeah.
So this is probably terrible radio for our listeners.
We're sitting here looking at the catalog.
The true gadget guys that we are. But yeah, we'll provide a link in the show notes to this thing, or you can go to that web address that I gave you just a moment ago and look. It's literally linked to on the front page. And thanks to John for sending that over. Really appreciate that. He's going to order a couple of those bee shakers. They're pretty expensive. I don't know, Bob, if somebody could figure out how to mass produce those. They're $26 for two peanut butter jars fused together at the lid.
Yeah,
I posted a video to our YouTube channel on how to make one of those.
Mm-hmm.
I did it with a soldering gun. But if you're not careful, it's easy to melt the plastic, and it's kind of a chore to build one. Not difficult, but I think I could do it for $26 for sure.
Yeah, you could waste a couple of jars for $26, right?
Yeah. The funny thing was I did use Skippy, and I don't eat Skippy peanut butter. So I had to have Sharon buy them and make the kids eat it. So
I guess the only other thing I would say about this catalog is, the shipping. Although you wouldn't think that the shipping would be probably any more than shipping from Midwest or California to the East Coast. This is coming right out of Canada, so I don't know that for sure, but I wouldn't think that the shipping costs are that much different.
Oh, wait, there's one page I need you to go to. Go to page 53.
Okay.
And look at the device on the bottom right-hand corner. It's called the cracker. Did you see that thing?
Give me 53, huh?
I'll spare the listeners. It's utilized for lifting honey supers to place a Bia skateboard, and it's this contraption that looks like it has a handle that goes in the handle of the box, and you pry it up, and it holds the box up so you could slide something underneath. This thing is cool. I don't know who made it, or it's $395, but this thing is neat.
Yeah, I see it now.
I want to engineer one. That's what you do. No offense to the manufacturers of these things, but it would be neat to figure out how to build one of those. I also like that box lifter right above it, if you've seen it.
Yeah.
Like a ring that goes around with a couple handhelds on it.
Yep, just make it a little bit easier to lift.
Yeah. Okay,
all
enough
right.
on that.
Yeah, enough of the catalog. Sorry, guys.
Go check it out, everybody.
And gals.
So, Bob, I think we're pretty close to being done here. Two things I wanted to mention. One of them was, the other day I was cleaning up my inbox, and I found all the analytics for my site. And I went through and I plugged them into Excel and just collated them. And I wanted to run through two views of the most popular episodes that the podcast had. I thought this was interesting. And I went back and looked at these, and I'm not sure why they're popular or what people are looking for. But let me do this one of two ways. The first one is, what's been popular looking at just the data from last year and this year, which shows? Because you have to think about some of the first ones have been out there since the beginning, and of course they're going to have more viability to have more hits. So number five was episode number 53. Number four was episode 40. Number three was episode 37. Number two was episode 57. And the number one episode over the last, since the beginning of 2013 until now, was episode number 50. And if I go look at the show notes for that, I see the topics were spring planning, Charlie Ilsley talking about how he processes wax, which I thought was pretty popular. I did a segment called Mistakes Were Made, where I talked about things that I have and haven't done well. Book insights, so I did a book review on that book that I lent you the other day, The Art and Adventure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just other listener mail and things like that. So I don't know why that was such a popular thing, but so be it. So the other thing that I wanted to present was, since the beginning of the podcast, which was May 1st, 2010, to now, the top five episodes, number five was episode 28, number four was episode 34, number three was episode 26, five was 28, four was 34, three was 26, the second most popular episode was number 30, and the most popular episode of all time was number 35. What's interesting to me, Bob, is the top five episodes of all time are not the top five in any way on the one from 2013 to 14. They're a completely different set.
So I think one of the nice things, Kevin, is that you put the show notes out, and you also put the timing, so you can go in and look for a specific topic that you might be interested in and go right in and find it. So I think that makes it a lot easier for people to find what they're looking for.
Yeah, you know that you and I both live really ridiculous lives sometimes from a schedule standpoint, but I do find that happy where I could go search my site and find something that I want to go back and refer to again. What's interesting, too, and every once in a while I go back and I listen, and I remember things that I had forgotten. So the whole point of the show was to record things for posterity that I could refer back to and have a body of work for my personal beekeeping. And I do find things that I've said or found in the past that I forgot about. And so I thought this would be interesting for listeners to say, what is everybody else listening to?
It'd be nice if people wrote in and told you why they were listening to those particular episodes. What is they're interested in, then you could tailor your shows to what people really want to know about.
I thought about, too, going back and looking at, like, best of, going back through the episodes of 2014, for example, now that we're in November, and putting something together for December, but those are nice to have. I don't know that I have the time. It could be something where I could ask listeners what were your favorite segments this year and maybe put those together in this type of review, because I have a recording of everything that we made, and it would be a lot of production value, but I could go back and pull out the segments and put them together and just put a show together for that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If I only had a staff.
Yes, in your spare time, Kevin.
Yeah.
You know? After you get home at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, I know. If I didn't spend all day on my hands and knees looking for my glasses in the grass and leaves. Yeah.
Been there, done that.
What a colossal waste of time with no productive value to it. I was so frustrated.
What's so funny about it is I was just telling you, I think it was on our drive back from the state meeting, about how mine ended up in the chipper.
I know. I was joking with Sharon that I was positive in the spring the first thing I'll do is go out there and mow it and run them over.
Yeah.
I'm guaranteed to find them at some point. So.
Oh, well.
Oh, well.
They're only glasses. They can be replaced.
They're really expensive, though.
They are.
So, Pop, one more thing. I don't know where it came across this, but there was a reference to a Kirk Webster article that I want to go read, and I started to peruse it, and it's called Collapse and Recovery. And what fascinated me about it and interests me that I want to go look more is he kind of alluded to in the opening that you have to suffer through a couple years and the bees have to collapse in order to be conditioned to recover and sustain. They almost have to go through a time of crisis is what I got out of that. Are you familiar with this article?
I read it some time ago. I can't really remember all the details. I'm actually looking at his website now. It's pretty interesting. He talks about things that Michael Palmer is talking about, keeping nukes. He was talking about that back in 2005. So if you get a chance and you go out to his website, all of his writings are there. Back, I guess, in the early 2000s, he was writing for American Bee Journal, trying to explain to people what he was doing and how he was a commercial beekeeper without any treatments. But, yeah, I mean, he talks about these cycles of collapse. And he almost that the bees, the insects, because he talks about insects in general, they need that as a way to be able to adapt. So I have to get back and read it some more because I really don't remember all the details of it.
Yeah, maybe you and I could take a homework assignment, go read that, and then just come back and see what our learnings are and see what we have. But I thought that was an interesting notion. There's a lot of insights going on with treatment-free. And another person that I'd like to go look in on is Dee Lusby, right? I know enough about her to what she's up to and whatever. Is she publishing anything more, or is her stuff historical?
I think most of it is. The only stuff that I've seen is out on BeeSource, and it goes quite a ways back. I haven't seen her really publish anything new. Although she's on the Organic Beekeepers Yahoo site all the time, so you can read some things there, but it's not like reading an article by her or a book, really understand what she's doing.
It's so frustrating for these people. The only person who's not been ostracized, to my knowledge, and what do I know, is like a Michael Bush, because, you know, you have Lesby. Michael Palmer's made out okay. I think people respect and understand what he's doing. But you do have other people who are doing their things in their own way, and if it's not the conventional way, they're being
dismissed,
challenged, dismissed, called crackpots, and, yeah. And it's a shame, because I've mentioned this before on the podcast. When I put together a team at work, I want that fringe person. That's the mm-hmm. one that's going to save your bacon. You know? You know
yeah.
what I mean by that, right?
I do, absolutely.
Yeah, you want somebody who's not going to be afraid to tell you what they see, and they're going to save you someday, right? So these are the type of people that, you know, sometimes some of them are just nuts. I'm sorry. That's
mm-hmm.
the way it goes. I've encountered some of those, too. And you can smell them a mile away, but every once in a while, you just need to let that fringe person go, and eventually you find out that maybe they were onto something. So, yeah, I always like to go look at stuff, and this Kirk Webster, I've known about him forever. I've heard Michael Palmer, when we went to go see him in New York, talk about him, and I've never had the time to go look in on what he's doing and what he wrote and what he's about.
So you're right. Let's take a homework assignment. I'll go out to the page, and we'll be able to come back and talk about collapse and recovery.
Okay, so we just crossed over an hour and a half. We shouldn't have talked about the catalog so long.
You know what? You may want to cut that out.
Nah, I'll let it ride. It was okay.
Well,
we did okay.
Okay.
So, all right. Well, you know what? That's, I guess, it. If you want more information, you can follow us on Beekeeper's Corner podcast page, www.bkcorner.org. I have a Facebook page, facebook.com/beekeepers corner. Bob, I've been posting some of the videos up from the NJBA meeting. I put the Keith Delaplane part 1 and 2 meeting up that recently the NJBA had. That's up on our Northwest page.
Yeah. I want to take another look at that, because his first talk on the hive as a superorganism was just outstanding. And I've already forgotten some of it, so I need to watch it again.
Yeah, I have the other two, but I don't have the names of the speakers. I posted the one, but I want to reproduce it so that we have the name of the speaker. It's only right to say who it was, but I don't think they introduced them. Do you remember introductions that day?
No, I don't. Actually, they just got up and started talking.
Yeah, I think they were kind of hustling them through.
Yeah.
Because Keith had to go early. So, and you know what? I found a video, a couple old videos. I've been cleaning up my video files, and I have some of those to post over the next couple weeks, some interesting things, especially that one from the spring where we were talking to Bill Heisley and talking about certain equipment. So Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers YouTube is youtube.com/NJBA. You could take a look there. And Bob, thanks for coming on. You and I have some really good dialogue, as you can tell from the thing, and always a pleasure to have you join me here.
Well, thanks. You know, the two of us are alike in one way. We can talk about bees for hours and hours at a time, whether people want to listen to us or not.
Yeah.
But anyway, thanks. This was a good way to spend a Saturday evening.
Yeah, don't be a stranger. We'll have to, November, December, we're not out in the bee yard or whatever. We'll have to put together. We'll just keep pulling out some topics and teeing them up and putting them down, you know?
Yeah.
All right, thanks, everybody. Hope you enjoyed this, and appreciate you listening to the Beekeeper's Corner podcast. Be well, everyone.